Hello and welcome back to the Chris Yeh podcast. I am, as always, Chris Yeh. I have a very special guest for you guys today. I'm pleased to be joined all the way from Malaysia by Tom Tao, who is the co-founder of Gobi Partners and a board member of Endeavor Malaysia. He is one of the legendary investors of the past several decades, a guy who has been involved with a tremendous number of fantastic causes, and also, interestingly enough, a guy who knows future Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Jackson. So with that, I would like to welcome you, Tom. Tom, say hello.
Hey, everyone. I'm delighted to be here and to be with you, Chris.
Thank you. So what I thought we'd do is go through your life, because it's been a very interesting life, and talk a little bit about your many accomplishments. You're probably way too humble to really talk about them, but I'm going to force you to. And then let's talk about some of these amazing things and causes and organizations you're working with now. And I'll close out with a couple of questions I always like to ask my guests. So let's start with the beginning. You grew up on Long Island. That's not where I would expect somebody who is one of the leading investors in Asia to grow up. Tell me about that. How did you end up growing up on Long Island? What was that like?
Well, Chris, first of all, thanks for having me. My story, I think, is a typical one, I think, of our generation. I think I always like to joke that my grandparents, and they fought on the wrong side of the war. I'm only kidding. But as a result of that, they were KMT, mm-hmm. And so like many people, perhaps even you, right? Our families were from China, had to flee to Taiwan. I think most families back then were looking for some sort of an insurance policy. So they sent one of the siblings. In this case, it turned out to be my dad and my mom, and they went to the U.S. My father followed a circuitous path to get to the U.S. And I was made in America. So then I was made in Brooklyn, born in Brooklyn. And then we made the move, like many families, immigrant families then, from the city, looking for a bit more space, and we ended up in North Merrick on Long Island, and I lived right across from the school, the elementary school, Fayette, and I still remember that. Looking back now, I mean, yeah, there were little bumps and bruises, hiccups along the way, but it was an all-American childhood, and I was just stunned by the generosity, I think, of that neighborhood and that community and the people I grew up with.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. My family was also on the Kuomintang side of the war. My Waigong fled the country on one of the last flights out. My parents it respectively traveled on various refugee boats to Taiwan. And so I think we have a very similar background. I grew up, as it turns out here on the West Coast in Los Angeles. But interestingly enough, my wife actually grew up in Long Island. Her family immigrated from Puerto Rico to New York City. And then, like your parents, when they wanted some more space, ended up moving out to Long Island. So it is a classic experience. We got a lot in common.
And so you'll notice, I think I've always envied the West Coast Chinese. I always thought they were a little bit more confident, when I would meet them later. I met a bunch of people, and we'll talk about this, but Love Boat, if you remember, Genton, I don't know if you did that. I was always impressed. The West Coast, the Chinese guys were always had a bit more, I think the East Coast guys were a little bit more.
Well, part of that you have to remember is because of the settlement patterns. Like, I grew up in Los Angeles, and we had a huge Chinese community in Los Angeles. Obviously, there's some very famous places like Monterey Park out in the Inland Empire, which are majority Chinese. And I grew up with a lot of Chinese American friends because my parents and their friends all came over for graduate school and had gone to UCLA and USC and other places like that and settled in Los Angeles, which was a land of opportunity. So I think you're absolutely right. I think I had a bigger community of Chinese folks around me when I was growing up. I didn't ever do Love Boat, but fun fact, I don't know if you've heard that there is a novel called Love Boat Taiwan.
Yes, Abigail.
So I don't know if you know Abigail. Abigail's a friend of mine, and you'll notice that one of the characters in Love Boat Taiwan is Xavier Yeh.
Oh, with you.
Now, I'm not going to tell you that international playboy Xavier Yeh is based on me, but I'm not going to say he's not.
You can neither confirm nor deny the rumor. I love it. I love it. Yeah, no, Abigail, again, I've never met her, but kind of know her because she's very involved in the Presidential Scholars community.
There you go. Well, we're going to talk about the Presidential Scholars Committee when we get back to it as well. Abigail, obviously, a brilliant writer. And it's one of these things where people are like, oh my gosh, Abigail, you're this overnight success. You got a movie coming out now and everything like that. And she, I think, had written 16 previous novels that went unpublished. She was always dreamed of being a writer. She was working on it, even as she was working in the high-tech industry for companies like Intel. And then finally, on attempt number 17 or something like that, she was published. And all of a sudden, she's an overnight success after having slaved at it for multiple decades.
Yeah, no, I think that's similar for most people. You know, what we hear about, you don't see, what you see is probably only the 10%, right, on the iceberg. It's the other 90% that people never see. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, let's get back to your childhood and growing up, because there are many sort of intersections with celebrity that we're going to talk about along the way. We already talked about Judge Jackson, but I know.
By the way, I just want to set the record straight on that. Again, I can't say I know her. My roommate from freshman year, Reggie, dated someone who was roommates with her. So, you know, at Harvard, you know, we like to, you know, maybe exaggerate a bit. So it's the associative it's a transitive property where, because I know someone who knows someone who knows her, I am therefore now very good friends with her.
Well, as we've observed, thanks to LinkedIn, as long as you're within one or two connections, you can get to anyone in the world.
There you go. There you go.
Speaking of which, your other cool celebrity friends, you went to high school with Debbie Gibson.
I
did.
What
on earth was that like?
You know, that I've actually, and this is a true story. I've known Debbie Gibson, well, I haven't talked to her since, but I actually knew her starting from fourth grade. So I went to an elementary school called Fayette, and she was at Camp Avenue. And there were three schools. There was also Old Mill. And we were all part of districts. I was part of a program was called, they had a gifted, talented program back then called Wings. And I knew her then, and she was already very brilliant. She was great. She was great academically. And, you know, she obviously, I remember our class went to Lincoln Center because she had a role in the opera in Hansel and Gretel. So she was always very talented. And then when, you know, kind of growing up, then, you know, we kind of were friends in junior high school. It's called Brookside. And what they did then was they kind of, we had North Merrick and then South Merrick. And so I, you know, if you're familiar with Merrick, which is by Jones Beach, you know, South Shore of Long Island, South Merrick is kind of the, you know, it's kind of the wealthier side because you're on mm-hmm. the South Shore, you're along the water and it's beautiful. And North Merrick was also great, but you know, more middle class, you know, more blue collar. And so Debbie Gibson and I, we were from kind of North Merrick. And when junior high school, they had a lot of the South Merrick who parents were much more, I guess they were the early tiger moms or dads before they had that term. And so that's why, you know, Debbie Gibson and I kind of just hung out more because we were from North Merrick. Other kids were from South Merrick. And she went on and she was always very, very smart. Always pursued her musical passion. And then I remember one year, you know, this was junior year. She was like, hey, and we always knew she was always in, you know, the dramas, the high school
right,
musicals.
She was always the lead in the musicals.
Yeah, she was that so drama talented. Person. But she'd miss chunks of school because she was also always auditioning, doing things. And then I remember one year she said, hey, you know, I'm going on this tour just during spring break. And she said, hey, I'm going down to Florida. You know, would you actually like to, you know, if you can come down. I know nobody believes this. I told my kids this and they're like, no way, Dad, she would never. And I was like, no, it was true. And back then there were no mobile phones. And I remember I ran up by my mom and my mom she's fantastic. She's, you know, she's one of those, you know, 4'11", you know, really tough Chinese moms, very focused on my academics. And I said, hey, Mom, you know, there's this opportunity. And my mother was like, what, a girl is going to call you? I wasn't allowed to date at all. And I remember one time there was a call And, you know, back then there was one phone. We had the black phone, you know, the metal phone that you could really probably break a door with. And I remember my mom picks up the phone and she's like, oh, no, hello. And she's like, Tommy, not here. And just hangs up the phone. And I was like, what? Who? I was like, who was that? I was like, hey, mom, was that? And I was like, was it a girl? And she wouldn't tell me. And I'm pretty sure at that point that that was maybe somebody calling me. And then my hopes of whatever just went away. So I didn't get to go on that you know, tour. Who knows? Life may have been different. I remember, what was that movie where the guy goes as a reporter?
Oh, you're thinking of Almost Famous.
Yeah, I think that could have been me had I gone on that. And from that tour, I think Shein had a huge breakout. And that's when that first song hit, which was Only in My Dreams.
Absolutely.
And I think
she was
the
huge.
Rumor was it was about some guy that I used to play baseball with. I don't know if the rumor is true, and I'd love it. I mean, I think it was about a guy called Anthony Valente who went to high school, played baseball with us. Well, you know, really good looking guy. And
that's
then
a good solid Long Island name right there.
There you go. So, you know, I mean, you know, so I grew up, you know, we used to go to Roosevelt Field, the whole mall culture. And it's funny because I think I'm so used to living in malls. That's one of the reasons why I love Malaysia so much, because Malaysia has some of the greatest malls in the world, Chris. So when you come down here,
I have actually visited Kuala Lumpur before, but it was a long time ago. I'd love to come again.
You got to come out. Hey, as a guest of Endeavor.
Absolutely.
Here, let's make that happen.
Wonderful. And then after high school, like every ambitious Chinese mother wishes, you end up going to Harvard University, class of 1992, along with your good buddy, Matt Damon.
You know, we were always known as Matt Damon's class. And so now I think with this Supreme Court justice, you know, I think, I'm not sure, I'm sure all the classes have their own internal, I'm sure Harvard's probably got this master list where they rank all the classes. And now with, you know, I think at Harvard, like if you have a president from your class, that's like, but having a Supreme Court justice, I think elevates our class just a little bit more now.
Well, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, you think about it. You have one president, you have 9 Supreme Court justices, you have 50 senators. Clearly, Supreme Court justice is like number 2 on the list.
So she's really given the class of 92 a lot of, you know, cred within the Harvard classes. So I think that'll be cool.
So, and I remember, obviously, we're not exactly the same age, but pretty close. 1992, you're graduating. And you're graduating into a pretty crappy economy, right? This was a bad time to be graduating.
Yeah, the Iraq War had just ended. If you remember, I remember even having debates like, hey, you know, back then, you remember we had to, was the selective service.
Mm-hmm.
In order
draft.
To get financial aid, you had to sign up for the draft. And I remember many nights, you know, watching on TV, it kind of reminds me what's going on now. But yeah, it was, was it Operation? I forget the name now. But we went into Iraq, and there was concern that, hey, maybe guys like us, we were of draft age, and if you took financial aid, you were eligible for the draft. And so I remember many late night conversations around that, and what would we do, etc. But you know, thankfully, it didn't come to that.
Yeah, no, I was there as a freshman when Desert Storm happened. So a couple years behind you, but absolutely, it was a major topic. Now people have to refer to it as the first Iraqi war, the first
Gulf
War.
There you go. That's right. Yeah.
So there you are. You're graduating in the aftermath of the war. The economy's in the toilet. And you somehow find yourself in the world of finance. How did that happen?
I got to say, I got very lucky. And again, my life, I feel very grateful for, there's so many organizations that helped me, as I'm sure they helped you, Chris. I was a beneficiary of an organization called SEO. At the time, it was called Sponsors for Educational Opportunity, founded by a gentleman called Michael Oshowitz, who's really, I think, one of the giants and has really changed the lives of so many people. And it was a program to help, I don't even know if this is the right term to use, minorities, Chris. I guess we were all minorities at the time and still are, I guess, in a sense. And it was to help to get Asian Americans, African Americans, at the time they were called Hispanic Americans, into Wall Street and consulting. And I remember, you know, I was looking for internships. Again, internships are always difficult to get. And at the time we had to write letters. And I remember licking so many stamps. You know, you had to lick the stamps.
We didn't have self-adhesive stamps. Yeah, that's a big advance.
Lick a stamp. It was so bad, my tongue just got numb because the glue, and I'm sure it wasn't very good for you. But I remember the summer because, you know, just like it is now, that internship junior year, that summer is so important. And I think, you know, for many people, that's why I'm really driven. As you'll see later on, it was just, you know, you go to school, I think for many first generation families, like, hey, you get to a great school, you won the race. And you realize that, you know what, the race has only started. And there's so many other things, you know, it's just like, you know, at Harvard, I also realized there were two Harvards. I mean, I was perfectly happy with my group of friends, small group of friends. And I thought I had a wonderful experience. But then when you watch movies like The Social Network, you kind of realize there was this other, and you know, it's the same thing. There's two Tsinghuas, there's mm-hmm. two Yales, mm-hmm. there's two. And so again, the internship game was one I didn't really understand. And again, you know, my dad was one of those guys, you know, he's hard of hearing, he's deaf. And so he's a guy who really made it through brute force. Mm. It was just, and I think for a lot of, Chris, you know, maybe your own parent, right? It was just, you know, the American dream at the time was just, you know, if you didn't succeed, it's because you didn't work hard enough. My father was a real believer in that. And I think that's what made him successful, because if you think about it, he couldn't speak very good English because he had a hearing problem. He came to America. So his Chinese was never even good to begin with. Mm. And so now you're trying to learn a new language. But again, America afforded him opportunities that he seized upon. He worked so hard. And so that was passed down, right? And so if you didn't get like an internship, that was your problem. So I'm sitting there writing letters. You know, I must have written 150 letters and not knowing how the game was really played.
Yeah.
And it was just rejection after rejection. And then it was like, hey, I remember talking to a friend of mine, a guy called Ron Mitchell. He was on the Harvard, from Long Island. He was a Harvard basketball star. And he said, hey, Tom, you know, this is not easy. And I was like, man, I'm failing. And he's like, it may not be you. He said, you should really try this program. He's like, he went through it. Mm. And then I said, oh, really? I said, hey. And then I applied. And I remember it was the worst interview I ever had. And there was this guy, you know, Walter Booker, who I'm still friends with today. I went down to Gramercy Street in New York. And I was like, I'm the guy. I'm gonna get in. And they ended up, I remember picking out one weak thing in my resume, which was, you know, freshman year, you know, you kind of like, hey, work so hard in high school and, you know, I want to have friends, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, let things go. Second
eased
semester.
Up a little bit. Yep.
Took my foot off and boom, man, I got a terrible grade in calculus. And I remember, and that's all Walter Booker focused on. None of the good stuff. It was just like, what the, and I was like, man, why are you busting my, you know, balls here? And I remember he looked at me, he said, you know, Tom, this program, it's not about you. It's about all the people who came in, who built the reputation of the program and who are going to come after you. And so if we put you in and you mess up, you take your foot off the pedal like you did, how are we going to make sure that you don't do that again? And I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
What a great question. And I had no answer. And I was just like, well, I thought I gave the worst answer at the time. It was the first thing that came to my mind. I walked out going, man, I wish I had a better answer. I just said, look, you don't think I know? You know how many opportunities I've missed because of that C, whatever I got on that? And I was like, oh, that was the dumbest answer. I only made him think. I walked out of there. My parents drove me back. 5-hour trip back from New York to Cambridge. I didn't say a word because I'm just like, you know what? What was this? You're like, wow. And then a couple weeks later, all the rejection letters came in. And just, you know, when you think there's nothing that's going to come, I get the call. It was a lay from, I still remember Denise Santana. She calls me. She says, hey, Tom, you're in. And I was like, I'm like, are you kidding me? I was like, that was the worst. She's like, no, we felt that you could handle the pressure. And at the time, I didn't realize, but I think SEO has now changed because a lot of people couldn't. It was, they had pressure interview tactics. Again, so for all you young guys out there, it was a different world. I mean, it was designed to break you. I mean, people would come out of that thing crying. I was close, I gotta say. I was like, what the? And then they said, look, we feel like, and then they put me into Morgan Stanley's capital markets desk.
Which is, of course, a great place for people who are shrinking violets.
It was like they were like, hey, we're putting you here. And I remember what I learned was you get these opportunities, you can't mess up. I couldn't afford to live in the city.
Yeah.
So I was living on Long Island, commuting in. And I remember that summer really kind of shaped me. I'm not saying it's for everybody, but I used to wake up my dad, and I gotta give my parents credit, every morning, 5:30. Get on the Long Island Railroad. Well, nothing more Long Island than that. You get your styrofoam, cup of coffee. I don't even think Starbucks existed back then. You're getting on the train. My dad was like, here's 50 cents. Get the Wall Street Journal. Read it on the train. And then it was, you know, you got to, I mean, SEO just taught me a work ethic, which was your first guy in, last guy out, no excuses. And you got to get a return off. And it was the most brutal summer, but it really, I'm sure, Chris, everybody goes through that. I mean, for me, that was boot camp. I mean, you know, it's, I can't think of it. It's just training. It sets you up. You just realize. And it was then that I learned that I didn't want to be on the trading desk. Because in Morgan Stanley, we were an Avenue of the Americas, Rockefeller Center. I mean, it was the best place, right? So you're working during the day, then SEO has all these awesome programs, networking, and you just realize what a responsibility. You got to represent, right, a little.
Mm-hmm.
And at Morgan Stanley, you know, Avenue of the Americas was prime real estate, right? I just remember, this. I don't know if this is an appropriate story, but the toilets were so close to each other. And sometimes you'd want to doze off because you're just so tired. Like, you exactly. Go there just to sleep a little. And then I realized, man, because it's so close, you could hear everything. And you're just like, man, every trader on the capital markets has indigestion. Because the stress, right? You're making tons Absolutely. Of money. But man, and I was like, I don't know if this is what I want to do. But I worked really hard. But then you start realizing, hey, what are the values that are important to you? And I just remember, I was like, man, I don't know if I want to have indigestion for the rest of my life if I'm doing this.
You learned something valuable in the bathroom as you're trying to catch a few winks. I hear you on that. I will say, I think that your answer ended up being a good one because, and I think you've probably gone through this yourself later on in your career, there are folks who've spent their entire lives succeeding. And to some extent, that's talent. To some extent, the way has been cleared for them. And the big question is what happens, like the old Dwayne Wade commercial, fall down 7 times, get up 8, right? Can you get back up? And they pressured you and you said, listen, I got back up after that freshman year because I realized just how much it cost me and I won't let it happen again. And I think that sense of, you know, being a battler, having a little bit of desperation, that's what they were looking for.
No, I think you're right. And I think, you know, that's just something everybody goes through that. I mean, you know, right. That's a common denominator. I'm sure you've heard on so many of the people you've interviewed. So you're right. I think everybody has that moment where they kind of go through. And I remember, I mean, today it was just, they threw me on the trading floor. They gave me, what is that, HP?
The HP 12C.
HP 12C. I still have it somewhere. And it was like, you know, reverse logic. They're like, hey, you're supposed to be the quant guy. And I'm like, all right. And they're like, go figure this out. The bond amortization, you go figure it out on Bloomberg. And they're like, go do it, the function. And I'm like trying to make 100 plus 100 work. And the calculator's coming up with error because it's reverse logic. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm stressing out. And they're looking at me like, you don't even know how to use this calculator. And I'm like, oh, it just, everybody goes through that. You know, and you know, I know for all the entrepreneurs out there, sometimes we ask you tough questions, but I hope this makes me a bit more relatable. But it was just like, yeah, and it was just, and I remember SEO. That was what was amazing. It was like, they're like, no job's too small.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you go to Harvard, whatever institution you're at, you're nothing. I remember, you're like, you're pond scum. You haven't made money for the firm. Nobody cares. If they ask you to Xerox papers, go do it. If they ask you to get coffee all day, go do it. And if they don't, go volunteer, go buy them cigarettes, go try to fit. I mean, it was just really like, it was just this unbelievable just attitude. And I think for me, it was, you know, because you think when you go to a good school, like, hey, I'm supposed to be the CEO after graduation. No, you're not. You know, it kind of gave you a little bit of an edge. And even if you didn't go to a good school, it doesn't really make a difference.
Right. In a couple of years, it's not going to matter.
You start from the same place. And in fact, what I found out later is if you go to a good school, in many cases, a lot of firms don't want to hire you because they think you're arrogant and you're not willing to really start at the bottom. And so I think SEO, I mean, if anybody's out there thinking about SEO, it is a one of the greatest programs. It, you know, along with, you know, Presidential Scholars is one. SEO is one that completely transformed my life. And again, I give so much credit, you know, for the people like Michael Oschwitz, Walter Pucker. You know, I learned from them. And then, yeah, you know, it's without that, I don't know where I'd be today, you know.
Well, let's get to that, because your career then takes a left turn, or rather an eastward turn, because you're on Wall Street in the heart of finance in New York City. And then you get an opportunity, something comes up, and you end up out in Asia, in Hong Kong. What happened? What brought you to Hong Kong and Shanghai and finally Kuala Lumpur?
That's a great question. I think, you know, it started actually, you know, during the training program. So I went from Morgan Stanley. I know I knew I wanted to get back, you know, get to banking. And so Merrill Lynch kind of recruited me hard. They were kind of the up and coming guys, you know, the top two firms, you know, kind of Goldman and Morgan Stanley. Merrill Lynch was the upcoming. And I kind of liked what they were doing. And I was like, you know, why not? And they gave me an offer early. I've always felt like you go to a place that wants you. Mm-hmm. So I took it early. I went. And that summer, that year when it was a depression, I actually had an offer locked up early.
Nice.
And so kind of, I guess the same thing, you know, people are like, oh, you should wait, go for Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs. And for me, I think at a certain level, it's the firms, the brands are the same. It's really the people that you're going to work with. And I liked the people there. I was going to be in the financial institutions group, and I went, and it was interesting. It was during that training, the analyst training program, I saw a guy, and it was weird because, you know, when you're everybody's young, you know, everybody's trying to be the guy, you know, be cool. And then I see this guy, and he's much older than everybody else. You know, we were all 22. That guy must have been like in his 30s. And he was older, and he's Chinese. Mm. Right? So I'm like, you know, who is this guy? And, you know, there were actually two guys. So one there was a guy, and it turned out his name is Zhang Liping. Liping. Mm-hmm. And he's in the training program. He's an associate, like the oldest associate. And every, you know, nobody, and again, all, you know, all the young guys, you know, where nobody's paying him any attention. And I go chat with him, and he's like, oh, I'm here. You know, Bill Schreier, I think, or was Kamansky. These guys were, Tully was the CEO. And they're like, oh, Merrill Lynch has big plans. We're going to open up a China office. We're going to bring the Thundering Herd to China. And Li Ping's like, yeah, I'm here because I wanted to start, really learn before I go back to Shanghai. And I'm, you know, talking to him in Chinese. And he's like, you know, God, you're the only guy who's talking to me. And I'm like, hey, no worries, man. He's like, hey, you know, and he's like, you know, if you ever get a chance, you should look me up. I'm like, oh, he's like, after the program, I'm going back to Hong Kong. And then there was another guy in that class. It was a guy called Fong Fong. Mm-hmm. Same thing. You know, he was in the normal associate, nicest guy. It turns out he's from my hometown, Anhui. And so we got to talking, and you know, it just, you know, because they were a little bit, you know, a little different, and you just go out and I'm like, hey, we're kind of homies, and they were laughing. You know, my Chinese accent wasn't great, you know, and they're like, you're trying, you know, and I was like, oh man, I'm like, my mother's from Anhui, and he's like, oh man, we're from the same hometown, and then Fong Fong and I started talking. And it was just those kind of relationships. And they were like, look, if you ever get a chance, and you know, these guys would come back to New York. And then because they knew I spoke Chinese, something that I really didn't want to do as a kid, you know, growing up on Long Island, I remember my parents, you know, the neighborhoods like, ah,
Chao Jia Tai, yao hui la la. I'm like yelling it in Chinese, and all the neighbors are like, what the? And they'd be making fun of me, you know, and I'm like, what are you doing?
Did you have to go to Chinese school?
We did.
Yeah.
Sunday, we had it. And then I stopped going because my parents, you know, and we didn't have enough. We didn't have enough of them like you probably did in California. Ours was very far away.
Mm.
And in fact, one of the guys who ran it was Charles Wang, the guy who would actually end up owning the Islanders. Yeah.
Computer Associates. Holy smokes.
Yeah. He was a big believer. So, you know, we'd do that, but then stopped. You know, my mother would teach us at home.
Mm.
But we kept up with that. And then, you know, it turned out, you know, that was a great thing. It's because I spoke Chinese, and I can't even say that well, that they were like, hey, you should come out to Hong Kong, because I reached out to these guys. And it turned out Li Ping and Fong Fong at Merrill, then these guys were the premier China banking team
mm-hmm.
in Hong Kong. And then they brought in another guy who, you know, sometimes life is just random events. There was another guy, I remember he was at Brown and Wood. He was a lawyer, wanted to do banking, and his name was Charles Lee. Charles Lee would become the head of the Hong Kong Stock Exchange.
I know. So Holy smokes.
I was, you know, and so they said, hey, come out to Hong Kong. So I did FIG for 2 years. And the decision to go to Hong Kong was easy. I mean, Chris, I don't know if you remember. I mean, I always tell young people in Hong Kong now, in kind of that 94, 95 time frame, Hong Kong, if you remember, Chris, was probably the most exciting place on the planet to be.
Absolutely.
It was more exciting than Silicon Valley, right? Nobody remembers that. It was just this heady mix, right? You had this Hong Kong, this bastion of, you know, fortunes being made overnight. You had this mix, you know, the Chinese were trying to be more capitalist. The capitalists were trying to be more Chinese, you know, understand Chinese communism. It was this weird mix, and anything was possible. Everyone wanted to go. And plus there was great expat housing and low tax rates.
Oh yes, absolutely.
So it was like the most coveted spot among analysts, and everybody wanted to go. And I think, you know, in every time frame, there's like this location that draws everybody, the young people of a generation. And for us, I think it was Hong Kong. And so, you know, again, without Li Ping and Fong Fong's endorsement, I probably couldn't get to go. It was very competitive. And I was very fortunate. I got to do my third year there. And that's how I ended up in Hong Kong.
And Hong Kong obviously was pivotal for your career. But then you take the next step, you end up in Shanghai, which is an incredible, incredible city. I've had a chance to visit a couple times. It is so vibrant and absolutely just growing like a weed. And you're there during some of these incredible high growth years. How'd you end up in Shanghai?
Well, Shanghai was, you know, again, I was in Hong Kong for a period of time. I was very fortunate, you know, again, switched jobs a couple of times. But as it turns out, you know, one of the clients we had was a firm called Beijing Enterprises. So I really got to know them, and it was through Fong Fong. And at the time, the Chinese government was really looking to study, you know, what made the U.S. successful. And one of the conclusions was the U.S. had this thing called Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember, you know, it's funny. So they had a lot of study tours that would come. And again, if you spoke Chinese and you take them to a nice Chinese restaurant when they came to the U.S., they'd like you more. And that's kind of what we would do. So I remember 97, if you remember, you know, the first Asian financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of kind of underemployed investment bankers looking for things to do. And it was at that time the Chinese government was trying to think like, hey, Asia is mired in this financial crisis, but the U.S. is still doing so well. Why is that? There were a number of reasons, but one of the things they concluded was the U.S. had this thing called Silicon Valley. And, you know, then they said, hey, how do we kind of create a Silicon Valley in China? So they got all these people, and then again, you got all these underemployed investment bankers in Hong Kong, and everybody starts pitching ideas. And I just remember saying, hey, listen, you know, God, Silicon Valley is powered by the ICs. And I'm not talking integrated circuits. I'm talking about the Indians and Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And here was my brilliant insight. Well, you know what? Silicon Valley powered by Indians and Chinese. You know what China has? China also has a lot of Chinese people. So it was like, why couldn't it work? And so it was just sometimes it's timing, context, things come together, and they wanted to create a Chinese VC fund. And at the time they were looking, the Chinese capital markets, RMB was even less convertible than it is today. Yep. It was really not a liquid capital market. So the idea was, hey, you need a US dollar fund, set one up. And they said, great. And they're like, well, who's got US dollars in China? And it was Beijing Enterprises, because they listed in Hong Kong. They had money. And, we set up this thing, it was called the Beijing Technology Development Fund. I was an advisor, helped raise it, put together partnerships at that time with Tsinghua University. Mm-hmm. And it was really early days. And we set that up. I don't think anybody knew what they were doing. I mean, I remember having guys in Silicon Valley saying, and it's amazing how Silicon Valley, because back then, Chris, I think it was like, if you had not been a CEO, you couldn't even be a partner at a Silicon Valley firm. Like, you had to have carried a P&L, managed people. And I remember they were using that lens and going, well, how can you be a venture capitalist if you didn't operate a company? Well, here's the interesting thing about emerging markets. Nobody
exactly
had it then. And so the model kind of changed. You couldn't use the same criteria. And so, right place, right time. I was very lucky, help them design the structure. And then Beijing Enterprise was like, hey, why don't you come run this thing? It's not like anybody knew what they were doing. I was like, okay. And so it was then we kind of created this model. It was called C2C. It was copy to China. And Chris, you remember the days back then. It was literally, if I were in Silicon Valley for like a week, I'd fly back to China and I would feel smarter than everybody else. Like you would go into the future, you'd come back to China and you'd be like, oh my, I'm from the future. I can see what's going on. And that, of course, that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the big changes I've seen in the last 20 years.
Well, this is one of the things that is the most remarkable, because this is my own bias showing through. But obviously during those days, things were being pioneered here in Silicon Valley and people could take the ideas from here and bring them back to China. One of the things that I feel like people really fall short on is, at this point, people in Silicon Valley should be reading what's going on in China or what's going on in India or what's going on in South Korea. Not that there isn't still pioneering work being done here in Silicon Valley. Of course there is. But there's great work being done elsewhere in the world. And there's this huge disadvantage if all the local information is not available in English, whereas all the information in Silicon Valley is and is being consumed by all these markets around the world.
I totally agree. And so that model where it was copy to China, C2C, again, we saw that. We'll get there, I'm sure. It was, and that's why I came to Southeast Asia, was we started seeing this trend called CFC. It was copy from China.
Exactly.
And that really, and you're exactly right. I mean, it was the same type of trend that we saw. And I think, for the next 10, 20 years, that's going to continue to play out.
Well, I can tell you, in my own investing career, one of the investments I made relatively recently is a company called Fossily in Brazil, which is the Brazilian Pinduoduo.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like we're literally copying from China, but now not copying to the United States, copying to other large emerging markets.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. And I think in some ways, the experience from China may be a bit more relevant for emerging markets.
Exactly.
Because you're dealing with a lot of the same conditions and demographics.
Exactly. When it comes to scaling up in emerging markets, again, China is not really an emerging market anymore, but for a long time during the period that you were doing this incredible investing, it was. The thing about emerging markets is, yeah, you don't have the same level of infrastructure that you do in a mature market, but on the other hand, you have to do the extra work to build the infrastructure. But once you build the infrastructure, you have even more of a competitive advantage.
There you go. Absolutely right. Yep.
So pretty incredible. And it's during this time that you're investing in all these different companies. So many of them go public, are worth colossal amounts of money. You're one of the most successful investors in the world. What's it feel like during that time?
Well, it feels good to get the validation, but there were many, bumps along the way. Right when we were about to hit, we were about to hit some real breakthroughs. And again, I've been through lawsuits Mm-hmm. We've had founders die. I mean, there's so many things that happen. It's never kind of a linear path. You know, but I do feel, you know, we were really, we're not only a witness, I think, which, you know, we played a small role. And I think that's very gratifying, to really, you know, see that and then play a little role in the development of that ecosystem.
So that brings us to Gobi Partners. I'm very curious. Tell me a little bit about starting Gobi. How did you pick that name and what's it been like? Because you've been doing that for 20 years now.
Yeah, no. You know, Gobi, it was funny. I remember being in Vegas the weekend before 9/11.
Oh, wow.
And I remember just, you know, playing, what was it, roulette, and just being like a little bit of a winning streak. And I'm like, and it was right there. I was like, you know, my partner, we're gonna set up Gobi. And then I was in New York. I wanted to tell my parents. And then I remember being in New York, and I was going to fly back to San Francisco. So I'm on the United Airlines flight.
Oh my gosh.
Last flight, September 10th.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there. So the flight, I was really tired, fell asleep. I wake up a couple hours later, flight's still on the runway. We're still in New York. I thought we landed. And they're like, no, there was a storm in Utah or whatever. We couldn't fly through and we're sorry for the delay. People want to get off. You can take the next flight tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, one of them was that flight. And I was like, looking at, I was a lazy guy. I'm like, I could go back. You know, I could go back to Merrick, but I had to wake up so early in the morning because it's the first flight out. I'm like, I'm not a morning person. I'm like, oh, forget, I'll just stay. I'm like, I've already spent all this time. I'm just going to stay on the flight. So I was saying, like, go back to sleep. And in like 10 minutes, boom, we're in the flight, in the air, get into San, very late. And at the time, I was living in an apartment building. I don't know if you know, it's called the Paramount. It was by the Sony Metreon.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly where the Metreon is. I'm not familiar with the Paramount, but I've been.
It's like a condo, really nice.
Absolutely.
I was living there. And I remember getting in there. And all of a sudden, I get a call from my cousin, Jimmy. And it's like 6 a.m. He's like, Tom, my God, turn on the TV. And I'm like, man, Jimmy, like,
it's 6 a.m. What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. This is not a time for a joke, right? You know, I'm like, I hang up. And then he calls again. He's like, and in this voice, he's like, seriously, he's like, turn on the TV. Something bad's happened. I'm like, what the? I turn it on. It's 9/11.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. And he's like, hey, come by, because he was at Berkeley at the time. But, you know, my relatives, he's like, just come by. We got to be together. I'm like, holy crap. And we go there. You know, after I process everything, then my next thought is, holy crap, I just left my company.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's going to happen? And I'm like, well, maybe we should try to get our old jobs back. But then it was like, oh, we decided to go ahead. And at the time, we didn't even have a name, really. It was just we knew we were going to leave and start something. And that's kind of how, you know, that I remember that very clearly. That so that was 2001 is when we decided to do it. And I think, you know, 9/11 also, probably for many people, I mean, it's, you just realize how precious and how random life can be. So if you're going to go do something, you just can't wait, you know?
Absolutely. So you start the company, you end up picking the name Gobi. I'm still curious why you picked the name.
Yeah, it's funny. There were many names before that. I mean, what we wanted to do was, you know, we were thinking, hey, we want to invest in high tech. We knew that. So we're like, hey, should we call a high tech fund? But there were many companies in China we call a high tech fund. And so we're like, well, let's be more creative. So we're like, what are we investing into? So back then, remember 2000, we're like, oh, it's me, semiconductors, connectivity driven by fiber optics. Okay. Well, we didn't want to call it that. We're like, what's the common denominator there? Well, the silicon. And then we're like, okay, well, where does silicon come from? Oh, sand. Now, where is there a lot of sand? Beaches. And so we're like, oh, so like beaches. Yeah, we'll call ourselves like, when we're like, hey, well, what's a place we all like? We're like Malibu. Chris, you're not going to believe this, but at one point we were actually Malibu partners.
Well, you know, Malibu is a place that's near and dear to my heart, having been there,
And then it was
growing up
like,
there.
I remember then it was like, well, people like Malibu, it doesn't sound serious. I mean, I don't know, it was like Malibu Barbie. And I'm like, well, okay, that's not good. And then we're like, oh, well, okay, where else is there a lot of sand? And it was like, oh, deserts. And then we're like, okay. And we look at the map and we say, perfect. We're going to call ourselves Taklamakan Partners. And so we were there. And then I remember we had the cards and it was like, everybody was like, Taklam, how do you pronounce that? And is this spelled the right way? Are you sure it's, all the A's, or isn't there an I? And we're like, holy crap. And then we look at it again, we're like, this is not working. It was like, are there other deserts? And then we look at the map and it was like, holy crap, Gobi. And
And it's even
that
in
was,
Asia. There we
and we
go, right
checked in
there.
China. It was like, oh my God, why didn't we think of that? And it was just like, was the URL available? Gobi.com was already taken. And we say, hey, let's do gobivc.com. We're now gobi.vc. And so, that's kind of how we started. And, it turned out to be, I'd love to say we did all this focus group testing. And it turns out Gobi's a pretty good name, right? Because if you look at all the great brands in the world, right? Nike, Disney, Gucci, Citi, Pepsi, Gobi.
It fits in.
I just think we got a little lucky there, and it's turned out to be something that easy to pronounce and people like it.
Very cool. And so you end up eventually in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur. So you're drawn there, you're figuring, hey, this is the emerging market, this is what's going on. And when you're there, you get involved with Endeavor Malaysia. Talk to me about Endeavor and how you got involved and what you're hoping to do there.
Yeah, Endeavor, I mean, fantastic organization. And I'd known of Endeavor before, and I got involved. It was really because of, it turns out a lot of our companies, our best companies, were all involved with Endeavor in Malaysia. And so I started saying, well, what is this Endeavor? And then the guy that really pushed me over was Eric Chang, the CEO of Carsum. And he was just saying, extolling the values and what they had been doing. And then, one day I get a call from Adlin, and he's the head of Endeavor, and Neil, and we started talking. And I was like, this sounds really interesting. A lot of the values are aligned. And again, our entrepreneurs who were involved with Endeavor had nothing but fantastic things to say. So I got more interested. Adeline, they had a great pitch. And then I met some of the other board members, guys like Avzal, and then also Bramal at Creador. And I was just like, oh, this is just a great group of people. And they said, I'm very happy and privileged that they'd want me to be a part of this. And so I said, fine, let's do it. And I think it's been fantastic.
Well, and that's also something. I mean, again, we're relatively close in age, and you get to a certain point in your life, you've got kids getting ready to go off to college, you got all this stuff happening, and you think to yourself, well, what's my legacy going to be? How am I going to give back? And obviously, something like Endeavor, serving on the board there, helps you to do that, helps you to bring on that next generation and, maybe also get some good deal flow.
No, you're right. Absolutely. I think the mission, what Endeavor stands for, very closely aligns to, I think, what we've been trying to do at Gobi anyway. And you're right. I think, VC, I really feel like is going to become, I mean, in a way, it's a financial technology in a way, right? It's a mindset. And I think every country needs it. I think it's a transformative kind of policy or toolkit for countries. And I think in a way, Chris, what we're doing is sometimes when I first came to a lot of the emerging markets, or even when I went to China back in 02, and I knew a little bit more about VC than other people, it was almost like I come with fire, right? It's like I bring this thing and I want to share it because I really think it can help transform people's lives and empower people. And I think that's what it's done. In a way, venture, when done correctly, it levels the playing field.
Yeah, it accelerates the pace of change. It puts resources in the hands of people who are most able to leverage them rather than the ones who are just the most connected.
correct. And I think if we can stay true to that mission, then you know, I think it really fits in. You can really make a, you can make a big impact.
So last topic before we go to our lightning round, and that is the U.S. Presidential Scholars Foundation. We referred to it briefly before. We're circling back to it now. Talk to me about your involvement with this foundation.
Yeah, well, the Presidential Scholars, you know, Chris, I don't know if you know this, but it's really one of the it's really one of the highest honors you can win as a high school senior in America. And I know my kids are always laughing, like, oh, Dad, you just peeked out there. And to a certain extent, they're probably right. But you know, what they do is it was set up in 1964, right? We just celebrated our 55th anniversary, you know, by President Lyndon Johnson. It's probably, mm-hmm. you know, one of his greatest, I think, achievements. And because what it did was very visionary. It, first of all, it was every state was represented, and it had to be one male and female.
Ooh, yes, that's so important.
Gender representation, broad geographical, and also Americans abroad. So it started off, you know, and then what they had was also scholars in the arts. Right? So it went from 121 to 141. Now it's also 161 because under President Obama, they also brought in technical training. Mm-hmm. Right? So 161. And, you know, it's a very rigorous selection. And you kind of represent your state. You have this national recognition program in DC where, you know, you meet the president. So I met President Reagan mm-hmm. when I was a senior at the Rose Garden. And they back then the program was a week. Again, due to government cutbacks, it's now only a day and a half, but you still have the program. You meet the president. And then you also have a Kennedy Center performance where the Presidential Scholars in the Arts perform. And it's amazing.
Mm.
And for me, again, what it showed was there were, you know, there were people who cared. And, you know, you feel like, I mean, for me, it's one of my mottos is, you know, with recognition comes responsibility. Like we were recognized at an early age. And you know, what are you going to do with that recognition? Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who care. There are people who, I mean, all volunteers, right? The White House Commission on Scholars, they bring in all these volunteers who go through these like 20-page applications. I mean, people have better things to do, but they really care. They select and you're picked. And I was very fortunate that I was asked and then elected to become the president of the Presidential Scholars. I always thought that was amusing. Then, you know, just to kind of organize the alumni. And again, we're coming up on our 60th anniversary, 2024. Chris, if you can come, love to have you come.
When's it's going to be in D.C.?
It'll be in D.C. And again, there are just amazing people that I've met through that program. For example, you know, one of our alum, somebody I've had the opportunity of meeting is Mayor Michelle Wu.
Wow.
Of Boston. She's a Presidential Scholar. And again, you know, she's somebody that's done a lot for the organization and never forgotten her roots and you know, real an inspiration for everybody. I mean, people like, again, Congressman Jamie Raskin,
mm-hmm.
right? Congressman Don Beyer. These are all kind of alum who have just, you know, represent really the best.
The best of America.
And again, somebody I've had really the honor of meeting and even giving one of our Presidential Scholars honors awards was Attorney General Merrick Garland.
Wow.
And so I remember giving, you know, every year we, and again, it's just been suspended recently due to COVID, but we have this in-person gathering where we really celebrate a lot of our alumni who represent the best of our values. We give them what we call the Roosevelt Thompson Award. And I had the opportunity at the time to give an award to, at the time, you know, Supreme Court, it was Judge Merrick Garland. And again, it was right after that period where he was blocked. He was not given the chance for his nomination.
That's right.
And you talk about somebody handling disappointment with grace. It was probably, I mean, from an outside standpoint, it was just like, wow, you're so close, but you're denied for purely political reasons.
Yeah. And knowing so going in, I mean, I'm sure he was a realist. He knew going in, he probably was not going to be confirmed. And yet, you know, he felt like it was his duty to go put himself forward regardless.
And I remember just asking, even just like, hey, how do you feel? You might, no sense of, it wasn't about it, that night. It wasn't even about him. And I just remember him saying, it was like, look, don't feel sorry for me. Just doing my job. It's just been an honor to serve. And if given the chance again, I'd do it gladly. And everybody was like, what could, is this guy unbelievable? Most people, I mean, if you, not at all. And then I really think when I certainly was watching, even though I was in Malaysia, watching the confirmation hearings, and that really came out, right? And so again, I think it's also a great lesson is, you again, like you were saying, fall down seven times, get up eight. Think about that. You're that close, but he continued to do, and he got another opportunity, right? He's now the Attorney General of the United States. Maybe he can even make more of an impact.
Absolutely. It's pretty amazing. And I heard you invite me to this ceremony, the celebration. I would absolutely be there. As long as you're willing to have a non-presidential scholar like me show up, I would be delighted.
Absolutely. You are friends of presidential scholars now, man. Yeah.
Well, and let me also mention, if you guys ever want me to do a talk, virtual, physical, what have you, for the young scholars or anything like that, do it on a regular basis. More than happy to do something along those lines because these are the most amazing young people this country produces, and it would be an honor to do something for them.
Chris, I'm going to take you up on that. And no, I think it is great because we also have a seed grant program where we, there's small grants, but again, it's to help presidential scholars really give back to the community and again, try to make an impact. So applying some of those principles, right, from venture into kind of the into the nonprofit sphere.
Well, I would be delighted. I also don't want to let it go by without comment that, again, we're talking about a program where you have one man, one woman from each state, and you were the pick for New York your year, which is pretty darn impressive. I mean, I hope your kids appreciate that is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it is. They probably say I remind them all the time. But yeah, no, I think, yeah, I know. I mean, when I was there, I hate to say this, but yeah, the New York guys would want to, the New York people want to check out the guys from California, Texas, Massachusetts. No disrespect to all the other, but yeah,
No
it's
disrespect to
a
Wyoming,
little
no disrespect to Rhode
bit.
Island.
But no, I have to say some of the other alums are great. Like, I mean, for example, one of the our alum is Pat Grady from Sequoia, and he's from Wyoming. So hey, there you go. Great scholars actually from all the great states.
Absolutely. I mean, each state, if you're a presidential scholar, you're a presidential scholar. No ifs, ands, or buts. All right. One last question, because I know we are a little over time, but I always like to ask this question. So one of the most important things I think is reading. And but there's other ways of read, right? These days we have Audible, we have all these different things. What is something that you have read or listened to or watched recently that had an impact on you? What's something that you would recommend to others?
Well, I think two. One is a book I read. And I wouldn't say recently, but it was during COVID. It was well, I think one book was called "Prisoners of Geography." Really interesting. In fact, I think that book really explains, in a small way, what's kind of going on with Russia and the Ukraine.
Yes, very true.
So that's an interesting. And the other one is, I think "Clash of Civilizations," which I think is very, very interesting. And I again, I think it predicted many things that are happening now. When that was that whole thing, it was like, oh, the end of history, the kind of the US had won the Cold War and it was over. But in a sense, I think that book really predicted what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Awesome. Well, Tom, I cannot thank you enough. This has been a lot of fun for me. I hope it's been fun for you as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Chris.
And I will look forward to hopefully booking some more time. We got to talk more. There's some incredible topics we barely scratched the surface of.
I agree. And I know you're a busy guy, but absolutely. Let's do that.
Fantastic. Well, everyone, huge thanks again to Tom Tao, T Square, as I'm going to call him from now on, for coming on the show. For those of you who are out there, as always, please do send in your feedback. Do share this podcast with others. tell everyone that you know. I'm telling you, this is an episode that nobody should miss. And of course, as always, I'm Chris Yeh, and thank you for listening.